You're listening to the public feed of Carefree Highway Revisited, which includes only a portion of this conversation. To hear the complete discussion, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or see the show notes for details. Hello, everybody. Hope you're doing well out there. What you're about to hear is part one of a very special interview that I did recently with Richard Harrison. That means the Richard Harrison, the man who was Gordon Lightfoot's road manager for most of the 70s and a little bit of the 80s. We had a great time talking, but the conversation went on for over an hour, and so I decided to break this episode into two pieces. So you will be hearing the next episode in a couple of weeks, but for right now, I really hope you enjoy part one of this interview, this conversation that I had with Richard Harrison, Gordon Lightfoot's road manager. Here we go.
The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
This is Carefree Highway Revisited, the show that celebrates the music of Gordon Lightfoot song by song, a proud member of the That's Not Canon podcast network. I'm your host, Mike Messner, and with me today is Richard Harrison, and Richard was Gordon's road manager for a number of years in the 70s and into the early 80s. Richard, welcome to the show. It is an honor to have you with us.
It's my pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
You wrote a book called Once Upon a Red Eye, and my first two questions for you is, number one, why did you write this? And number two, is there a significance to the title?
Well, there have been three bios of Gord out. Two of them, as far as I'm concerned, you could use for toilet paper. They're just a compilation of interviews, news. They never met him or anything. The only one that's worth reading is by Nick Jennings, who's a very famous biographer. Mm-hmm. But all three of them put together, they only tell one side of the story. They don't say anything about what happened on the road. And I felt this was a missing link. It needed to be filled out. So I did that. And when I was halfway through, I approached Gordon with it. And he was thrilled because he, too, recognized that to complete his story, you had to have the experiences on the road because they were half the story. Writing, his personality, the story. They're the three things. So I finished the book, and he must have really loved it because he wrote both a back cover endorsement and he wrote the foreword to the book. And that's something he's never done for anybody else. As a matter of fact, we had a pet phrase, which we stole from Simon and Garfunkel. We called them bookends, because if you put the Jennings bio and my books side to side, that's the complete story. He was very happy about it.
I should just say that I have the Jennings book here on my desk, and I use it when I'm preparing to do these podcasts. And I've also am about halfway through with your book. And that's really kind of all I need to know, that and the experiences that people have had with Gordon and with his music, of course. So the significance to the title, Once Upon a Red Eye, why did you choose that?
I thought it was cute. No, seriously, red eyes, they need an aircraft somewhere. And so they'll fly at deadhead if they have to. But why not open it up for seats? Now, these flights typically leave at about midnight, and you get in feeling like death warmed over at about 7 in the morning. But they're necessary. There's one chapter in the book where Gordon was finishing up at the Universal Amphitheater in North Hollywood, and he was hosting a CNE benefit with a whole bunch of other talented artists at the CNE in Toronto the very next day. And so we packed up the equipment after the show and just headed, no hotel, nothing, just headed straight for the airport and took a red eye. And this happened on occasion. That's the significance of the title.
Okay. Well, that makes perfect sense. And we'll talk a little bit more about the traveling as we go through here. Now, you started out in your early days, you were in close contact with Jim, later Roger McGuinn. And I know that he changed his name, but what was he like in those early days, in the early days of the Byrds?
Roger's a very sort of laid back, I'd rather be an observer than a participant sort of guy. But once you get to know him, which I did very well, of course, because it was with the Byrds that I cut my teeth, he had a wicked sense of humor. He had a crazy side too. For instance, he was driving a car in Midtown Manhattan. I was with him and Clarence White was in the back seat. And Long story short, I think he was a New York cabbie wannabe. He was a madman driving.
David Brenner said it best. He said, whenever I'm in a cab in New York, I always feel like I should be leaning out the window, shooting the car behind me. And it sounds like Roger was that kind of a driver.
Yeah. We're still fabulous friends. We were in contact even today. And we have a couple of things in common, one of which is an absolute love for the movie Dr. Strangelove. And every once in a while, I'll find a little nugget, or he'll find a little nugget, and he'll send it to me, or I'll send it to him. This is our bond.
Very cool. And I'm sure you both have seen the movie several times then.
I once knew every line in it.
Wow. Okay. Now that is a devotee. Very cool. Yeah. Did you get any contact back in those days with the recently passed David Crosby?
Well, first of all, David really didn't have any use for me at all. He was kind of a narcissist. And before I go any further on that, he is definitely one of the best high harmony singers in the world. No question about that. He is what completed unique sound of the Byrds. But he liked to take over. For instance, at Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, after one song, he started to get in on the Kennedy assassination and how there's no way Oswald acted alone and there's the grassy knoll. And he's taking up stage time with all his talk. And you should have seen the look on Roger's face. He was just fuming.
I've seen Monterey Pop, and I think Roger went on record at some point and said that was the beginning of the end of Crosby's time in the Byrds. He also substituted for Neil Young when Buffalo Springfield played at Monterey. And I think less than a year after that, and maybe just within a few months, he'd been kicked out of the team.
Try a month after that.
Yeah. So very, very shortly after that. So where did you learn to do lighting and sound and the other stuff you did for Gordon? The book does talk about how you came into contact with him and how you got the gig with Lightfoot. But how did you learn your craft? Was it something that you studied? Was it something you just picked up? Did you kind of learn by doing on the job? How did you cut your teeth on the jobs that you did for Lightfoot?
Well, we'll start with sound. My mentor was my father. He was an electronics expert and things like that. And he got me interested in that because he was in the business himself. He did sound and lighting and everything. It was just sort of something that started. For instance, when I was 12, he produced a musical about the life of Tom Sawyer, you know, Mark Twain. And he asked me to do a safety copy of the sound when it was aired. And they ended up saying that my version of the show was better than their professional.
No kidding. Wow.
And then I got into, you know, stereo, and I got into very advanced stuff, like when they were first out, graphic equalizers and parametric equalizers and all these things. And so that was a natural sounding board, a natural path to doing Gordon sound, which I did for a number of years. Lighting, I picked up along the way. Started out very simple because I really didn't know what I was doing. But time, experience, learning things, and it finally came together. So I did that for a number of years. And as Gordon says in the foreword, I did those jobs simultaneously.
That is a huge load. And of course, we know that Charlie Morgan came on the scene in later years to sort of take some of that load off of your shoulders. And
that's exactly what Gordon said, yeah.
Okay, yeah, that may have been his exact words. And the book does talk about that a lot. You were at a lot of different venues for Gordon over the years. Can you remember the biggest venue that Gordon ever played and what that show was like?
Biggest venue. Now, you can define big. Is that the size of the venue itself? In that case, it might be the Salt Palace in Salt Lake City or Royal Albert Hall in London. If you mean big by the number of people that attended, well, you've got Massey Hall, up to 8 shows in a week. So 3,500 times 8, you can do the math on that one. That was the number of people. Royal Albert Hall was always sold out. I think it's around 5,000 or something like that. And of course, well, the CNE, who knows how many thousands and thousands of people were there at the benefit for the Olympic team, which had to withdraw because Russia was up no good, as usual. Those were very, very big. And of course, it all happened after sundown. You know, we were doing the colleges and universities and even Carnegie Hall. But as soon as sundown went number one, the whole thing changed. And Gordon started doing 2 shows a night. Why? Because the promoter rents the building for the night. So, you know, let's double up and make some money.
And I can only imagine how exhausting that must have been for the band. I mean, to be doing two full shows a night. So you talk a lot about each of the members of the core group in the book. You talk about Pee-wee, you talk about Red, you talk about Terry, you talk about Rick Haynes, and I think you talk about Barry as well. One person that you didn't talk about quite as much, Ben, I'm wondering if you have any recollections of this. My listeners can buy the book if they want to know the entire thing. But John Stockfish was around in the early days before he turned it over to Rick Haynes as the bass player. Any memories or stories about John?
Only one, and it's easy to say only one because I only met him once. And that was after Gordon's concert at the Fillmore West in San Francisco. And that was also when I met Red Shea. It's a very interesting story about how I met Red. Much too long and involved to get here. You got to read it in the book.
Yeah.
Everything we're talking about now is Cole's notes. The entire treatment of all these things that we're talking about is in the book. It was kind of funny because Red knew I played some guitar, so he handed me his guitar backstage after the show and said, play something. So I noodled around. It was horrible. And I could see this smirk on Stockfish's face, like, yeah, John, I deserve that.
Now, at some point, Red left the band and then came back. And so it was a five-piece band in the mid-70s after Sundown, where Red and Terry were sharing lead guitar. And I'm wondering, what was the dynamic between them? Was there any discomfort? Did they have any bitter feelings toward each other? Or did they really get along well?
One of the unique features of the Lightfoot Band is everybody got along. We got along. We all had our ways of contributing. Gord was the focal point, of course. But Gord, in a radio interview, said something about that. Why we lasted so long? Because we all get along so well. That's what he said. Red, and by the way, his coming back in the band was only for like a month. He was truly road weary.
So there wasn't a whole lot of time for there to be a whole lot of tension built up between Red and Terry. Everything I've read about the two of them seems like, at the very least, they respected each other and probably played off each other fairly well.
Yes, especially Red, but Terry as well. They wouldn't get in each other's way. There were certain songs, like for instance, on Sundown, Jennings made, that was the one boo-boo in his book. He said Terry played the solo in Sundown. No, it was Red.
Okay.
So he would play that. Also, on two or three songs, Red used a unique instrument called a high-string guitar. It's almost a 12-string. It's a 6-string, but the lower notes are tuned an octave higher. Songs, for instance, like Don Quixote and Ode to Big Blue, the whale song, Red played a high-string on those, and he did in concert because that's what Gord's product was at that time. But as I say, it was only for those times. And at Royal Albert Hall, Red, interestingly enough, used my D18, my Martin D18, to play at Royal Albert Hall. It was strung, of course, as a high string.
The reason I ask is that when you hear about bands that have two lead guitarists, sometimes it is beautiful and other times there's too much fire going on. You think about Buffalo Springfield with Stephen Stills and Neil Young, and they're having volume duels when we're together in CSNY. You think about Don Felder and Joe Walsh and the Eagles. As far as I know, those guys never stepped on each other's toes, but you have so much talent. You have a lot of potential tension that can go on between the two lead players. And it doesn't sound like that was really a factor with Red and Terry.
No, not at all. As you know, again, I got to go back to Gordon's quote, we get along so well. That says it all.
Yeah, and that's what you got to have if you're going to be in close quarters with each other for so long. Well, that's all the time we have for Here in the Public Feed. If you'd like to hear the rest of this conversation, along with all of our other extended and bonus episodes, become an FM Plus subscriber. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com. You can see the show notes for details.